Well, hi there, everyone. It's the Rugby Pass podcast. It's Thursday today, a Thursday in New Zealand at least. I don't know what day of the week it is where you're listening, but I can safely tell you that it is the 12th of May here. Scotty Stevenson with you on the pod, along with Duncan Grieve, editor-in-chief of the spin-off and rugbypass.com, and the editor of Rugby Pass, Hayden Donald. Good morning.
Hello.
Or is it afternoon? It's hard to say. What's not hard to say, guys, before we get into today's feature conversation, which will be about what do sports around the world do that rugby does not do? It's an interesting chat, but straight off the bat, Super Rugby, Hurricanes, five of them suspended 1 week for missing a curfew. Let me just go through the names for you for a second, Dunk. Corey Jane, arguably their best finisher. Julian Savia, probably better finisher than Corey Jane. Victor Vito, Artie Savia, and Chris Eaves. Four of those players, oh, not to mention Victor Vito, that's six players. Four or five of them, absolutely fundamental parts of the Hurricanes' playoff chances. They missed a curfew. Do you drop them for a week when you are literally chasing down the lead in the conference?
I'm in favour of it in general because, you know, I feel like team discipline is super underrated, and it's really hard to create and it's really easy to lose. And if you have different rules for your superstars than you do for your players, it gets really corrosive really quickly. And, I mean, you saw what happened with that kind of ragtag Warriors team, switching codes for a second, that went out and played in the absence of all their suspended stars. They won against, admittedly, a pretty ordinary St. George outfit. But there's something about the kind of what it says to both the senior players who are dropped and the you know, the less kind of well-known players who get a spot that I think can be quite helpful. Only kind of issue is, I guess, that the Hurricanes have quite a long history of sort of battling player power and so on. So this could turn toxic really quickly. What do you think, Scotty?
Well, I just look at the calibre of players here. When the story first broke, you know, the first thing that came to mind was, okay, it's some young boys in the Hurricanes who have had a bit of a blowout and come back to the hotel late and they'll be dealt with internally. When you read the names, both Savias, Corey Jane, Victor Vito, I mean, these guys are four veterans of your team now.
Mm.
They're senior players. Chris Eaves hasn't been around that long, but still, he's one of your enforcers in the front row. So to me, it's not the fact that five players missed a curfew. It's who those five players are. Mm. And they are fundamental to that team culture that you spoke about, Hayden. I think if you're in the coach's shoes, I guess you're left with no choice but to set an example.
Well, it says bad things about the whole culture of the team, doesn't it? That the senior people are the ones that are going out and doing that are going out and breaking the rules. But this is such a weird debate. Like, why are we talking essentially about punishing grown men for staying out too late?
I know.
But this is weird.
But a rule is a rule, and it's the team's self-imposed curfew. I mean, what I find staggering here is Corey Jane. I remember in his book saying, you know, once he was late for a recovery session in South Africa. And at the time, Tana Umanga was his captain. He said, I've never been chewed out so badly in my life. But same country, same team, different captain, granted, same mistake. We're talking 10 years apart.
Didn't Corey go out with Israel Dagg during the 2000s?
He may have some form here.
And I think that's the problem, right? That I think, you know, teams are quite complex organisms because, you're trying to have sort of succession and mentoring and allow for sort of all these kind of really important things to happen within them. And if you develop a culture where the sort of moral authority that you demand and is really positive when the senior players possess it, when that sort of dissipates, it's amazing how quickly people can just stop giving a shit. And, you know, it's 1 week and obviously at a critical time of the season, but I feel like that as a general principle, doing it once and doing it hard rather than letting a little bit of these kind of things happen and then having to try and, once you've set that precedent, you're kind of stuck with it.
Yeah.
I'm sort of in favour.
Yeah, except for like, I'm an NBA fan and you see something like this happen with the Sacramento Kings this year where DeMarcus Cousins just kept getting suspended for battling with his coach, and then that didn't actually end well. It just ended with a huge player revolt, and they just stopped paying attention to their coach.
Yeah, I don't see this
as the other way.
That's right, and I don't see this as a battle between the players and the coaching staff. I think somewhere here, this team has just forgotten what they're there to do.
Mm.
They are still in the playoff hunt. They set the team dynamics. And in fact, in Super Rugby, you'll hear coaches talk about it all the time. We have leadership groups. Those are the players in charge of setting the tone for the team, setting the standards for the team. I can guarantee you that at least two of those five are in the senior playing group in that team. In the same way, what you mentioned, the Warriors, some of the players involved in that are stalwarts of the club. It's when these guys start acting up, which brings to mind a secondary issue. We all talk about young professional athletes, and rugby is a new professional sport by world standards. We all talk about how great it is to be doing what they do, to be playing rugby for a living, to be well remunerated for it. Are we starting to see a generation of players in a generation of social media and instant feedback and the loop of criticism starting to buckle more under modern pressure than perhaps the generation before?
I mean, I don't think behaviour... I think we're probably looking at both the best behaved generation of rugby players that the world has ever seen and also the most scrutinised and therefore the most kind of pilloried for what would have been seen as not even minor infractions, but just kind of normal behaviour, even 10 years ago. So when it was still a professional sport, but before, you know, the kind of scrutiny got in there. But, I mean, that's just the kind of the new reality of it. And in some ways feeds into what we do want to talk about today, which is a draft and, you know, trades and some of the stuff which does tend to, you know, to be large parts of the culture of other sports that just doesn't exist in rugby. Because I do think there's something a little bit strange in rugby where those players do have an incredible amount of scrutiny on them. They don't actually have the kind of the compensation which we consider to be part of why it's fair to have those kind of rules, to have that kind of scrutiny which exists in other sports. And some of that is related to the fact that rugby is actually essentially kind of, at least as practiced within New Zealand, is kind of borderline communist in terms of the level of central control and the way that it's governed.
You're on the Rugby Pass podcast, and our feature conversation today is talking about rugby union in the context of professional sports around the world. And as Duncan Grieve, editor of the spin-off from rugbypass.com, and now Rugby Pass editor Hayden Donnell have mentioned today, the draft is one area of rugby where I know a lot of people for a long time have been looking for an opening, a way to say, let's take the pool of talent at our disposal in this country and let's make them bid. We don't do that at the moment, Hayden. What tends to happen is you've got Super Rugby franchises via their provincial unions paying schoolboys a stipend to keep them in the region in the hope that that investment will pay off long term. Is it time that we had 2 days of horse trading? And what you get is what you get.
I would love that. That would be excellent. Partly because I'm from Auckland, and as a Blues fan, it might be the only thing that will ultimately get players to...
First pick every year, baby.
...to come to the Blues, you know? Just the biggest loser in last year's Super Rugby gets to pick first. Man, we're going to be in the money. It might be the only way to turn a franchise around. And that's actually a good point. Drafts are a way to turn bad franchises around, and as it is, we have... just the winners kind of amassing more and more talent all the time by virtue of being winners, and they get the best choices and then they keep on their winning ways. It gets a bit boring, so I'm in favour of a draft. It would also just add excitement.
Oh, I agree on the excitement point, but where I differ slightly with you is that the drafts really even up a championship. I mean, the same teams tend to make it through to the playoffs every year in the NBA, you give or take a few. And when, how long does a draft take to pay off? If you get the first pick in the draft in, say, 2014, when can you expect that draft pick to pay for you? And is it enough to get a team over the line?
So you still can't have a dysfunctional organisation. That's the thing. You have to have a good general manager in place that's willing to put a long-term strategy in place, and then you harvest these good players over a couple of years where you underperform, and then maybe in 2 or 3 years' time you've actually got a really good team. It's going to be more effective in the NBA where you only have 5 players on the court at one time than it is in rugby where you have 15. So yeah, in rugby, the organisation is always going to play more of a role. But come on, just can't it just be more fun? A draft is more fun than
agree.
Like a back office deal.
I totally agree with you.
It is a lot more fun. I think a draft performs a number of functions really well. One of which, and we haven't really discussed this and it doesn't often get talked about, but it's a way of introducing a generation of new players to their public and incentivizing kind of new stories about them, research about them, analysis of their strengths and weaknesses. And obviously there's a whole other conversation about, you know, these are 18-year-old boys essentially that we would be talking about, and, you know, are they ready for that scrutiny? I personally think it's the positives of it far outweigh the negatives. So, you know, it's a huge media spectacle that you would introduce, and it's a way of basically, you know, there is a talent redistribution element, and I don't think that's ever going to be enough to counterweight a good culture and a good coach and a good organisation. But it you're selling hope, you know, and New Zealand franchises historically have gone long periods without them. And if you've got, you know, like there was a period of time when all our franchises had essentially the same jerseys with the same sponsor on them, right, and they swapped out the colours, and you start to feel like you're supporting the local branch of McDonald's. And that seems weird. And if you don't have hope for the future in that situation, then you're really in trouble. A draft, like, at least if you can start to, you know, your team tanks, season's done, but you can start to look at what you might get in return for your team being the toilet, that's good.
You're right about the homogeneity of the whole process, but I guess you have to have a look at it as well and say, from a New Zealand perspective, they would say, well, schoolboy rugby is televised here. That's where your talent is going to be identified. We have an under-19 competition. That is televised. You can identify talent there. Most of these players will play semi-pros in the Mitre 10 Cup, now the National Provincial Championship. That is televised, so you get to look at the kids there. I wonder if we need to go a step further. Because Super Rugby is a pathway competition, international rugby in this part of the world at least still is top dog. Provincial rugby here is a pathway to Super Rugby. Super Rugby is still a pathway to international rugby. So it's not of its own. It's not a standalone competition. In fact, anyone who watches Super Rugby will hear the talk after week one, oh, this guy could make the All Blacks. Like, it's ridiculous. Yeah, you know, you're 1 week into a professional competition and someone's talking about a player playing for another coach and another team in another tournament. I tire of that. But it's all about control. New Zealand Rugby wants to control its player resource. It wants to have that pathway, that carrot that it can dangle in front of these players. Should Super Rugby have a draft across the hemisphere, the best 50, 60 kids from across South Africa, Argentina, Japan, New Zealand, Australia go into a draft and any team can pick them. Is it time that we expanded outside the borders and said, you're all playing Super Rugby, you can play for any team you wish?
Well, you could go wider again and say that anyone can elect for the draft. You know, you could have an amazing American college player or an English player who wants to experience Southern Hemisphere rugby. You just declare for the draft the same way the NBA does. I personally think that that's probably the only fair way to do it. Otherwise, you might get a weird thing where, you know, the New Zealand draft just looks really hard, and so a guy who might have gone...
Yeah, there's only two places every year in the teams. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about 10 guys in a draft. It's all done in 5 minutes. I mean, that's hardly the spectacle we're after.
No, it's not. And so you know, it probably... And again, though, this does feed into this broader question of the whole structure of New Zealand rugby, where do you need to have private ownership for this thing to happen effectively? Because if you have draft picks, they need to have a value, you know, trade. So the whole structure, you can't just impose a draft on our current structure and expect it to perform the same way that it does in other countries.
Here's a question for you and for both of you. At the moment in the news, Lee Halfpenny, he signed with Toulon, he's been injured all year. He's been picked by Warren Gatlin to tour New Zealand with Wales. His private owner of his French club, Toulon, Mourad Boujalal, has said, oh, that's fine, but I'm not paying you. Now, he's going to be picked for an international team in a declared World Rugby international window, and yet his private owner has said, oh, well, screw you, I'm not paying you. Let's put aside for the moment that Mourad is absolutely batshit crazy and get to the point here. I mean, that is a failing of private ownership, isn't it? When someone has said, I don't care about international rugby, I don't care about world rugby, I've bought these players, they are my toys.
Is it even just private ownership, though, or is it that your primary source of income is not coming from international rugby, it's coming from the domestic competition? You see this in the NBA, where Stephen Adams won't be playing for the Tall Blacks this year. You know, half of their... all the French players, Rudy Gobert, others won't be playing for France, you know, because their primary source of income is coming from the NBA.
Are they pressured, though? I mean, right? Are they feeling pressure to do that? Are they saying, well, who cares about international basketball? Because from my point of view, international basketball is not international rugby. We know that international rugby still sits as the pinnacle, really, of the game.
But maybe but that's
not the
a
same
failure.
In any other pro league. Maybe it is a failing.
See, I think this is probably heretical to say in New Zealand, but I think it would be better for world rugby if the All Blacks weren't seen as the absolute pinnacle of the sport. Like, if you had, like, if the five New Zealand franchises were instead considered the most important clubs in the world, and that the world rugby's best teams, best competition, which it already is at a club level, does happen in the Southern Hemisphere. But if, you know, it almost needs New Zealand rugby to say the All Blacks aren't the most important thing in the world, which absolutely is a heretical thing to say. But do we really need to win like 94% of our games? Could we live with 85% if it were?
Yeah. But here's the thing, are they saying they're the most important thing and they need to win, or are they saying because they win and because it's the most recognisable brand in New Zealand rugby's book of brands that's where they throw their resource? Because you could argue the Highlanders now have gone and courted Japan, not only in selecting players out of Japan, but in really courting commercial sponsors in Japan, selling their jerseys, looking for fans. Other teams have gone out across the west coast of America to South America looking for partnerships. So these brands, I mean, you talk about private ownership. Here, Super Rugby teams, the marketing rights are owned, but the teams and control of the players,
which is
coaches,
a shambles.
Well, it is a shambles because I just don't understand how that works.
Yeah.
Private ownership adds, well, the main thing to me that it adds is this real aspect of volatility. I mean, you still have that sort of on the, as Duncan says, the communist level that we have it now. But with private ownership, you have pretty much mad people that take over franchises,
right.
and then
mad rich people. It's the funnest thing in the world.
Know,
to watch.
Which is great for your franchise, or you've got a real good one who kind of like just gives you a lot of money and stays out of your hair and just lets the GM take over, and it's all good. So I mean, private ownership will either make your team much stronger or will completely bomb it. I guess either of those outcomes are very exciting.
Let's go one step further.
Owen Glenn taking over, the Highlanders or something.
Would be terrible because he would rename them the Owen Glenn Highlanders.
It would be very exciting.
Here's a thing for you. We've talked about the draft. Let's say a draft is instituted one way or another. Let's say we have private ownership and genuine private ownership in franchise rugby. What then do you make of the ability for trades, for players to make a decision to leave clubs, or for other clubs to say, you know what, we want that kid halfway through the season, we will pay you $1 squillion and a transfer fee, and he is ours.
And a couple of draft picks, all in favour of it. In fact, it's the only way that kind of draft private ownership ecosystem can work is if there's also trades, because, you know, that again, it's hope. It's hope that to be a genuine fan of something that is not just an automaton who turns up every day. They have to believe that someday the storm will break, and a trade provides that ability to happen tomorrow. You know, it's not like a draft pick. The trade is the most kind of vital constituent of that whole ecosystem, and I personally think that it should happen. The only issue is, and again, this comes down to the sort of ownership structure. A Super Rugby player is paid sort of 70 grand a year. If you get traded from Auckland to Dunedin and you're being paid 70 grand, admittedly that's the sort of entry-level salary, you're relocating your whole life, potentially your family, your job for, you know, a pretty ordinary wage. Well, that's the problem. Yeah. That's probably why they can't do it in a way.
Yeah, but it's, the funny thing is, it's why Auckland can't attract players, because they can't afford to live in Auckland on the base salary of a Super Rugby player. That's why they'd rather go to Dunedin and Hamilton and Christchurch, where they could actually afford the rent. Oh, it's a complicated structure.
I would
structure.
Be pretty unhappy if Duncan traded me to the Dunedin branch of the spin-off.
You're going to Fairfax.
We would all be very unhappy if they traded you away.
Okay, I really appreciate that vote of confidence, guys. But with the package of everything else and of private ownership, injecting more cash into it, and increasing kind of sponsorship and interest that comes with adding a draft, then you could maybe up the salaries to the point where trades are actually possible.
Grow the pie.
And I think I'm most in favour of this idea. Of all of the ideas that we've put forward, this one's, I think, the best. This is the vital thing about giving you hope for the future, as Duncan says.
It's just very deep, that line.
We're from Auckland. We've lived hope. With this just dire, endless, stretching hopelessness for so long. Imagine if it could all just be turned around by trading for Waisaki Naholo.
That'd be amazing. That'd be amazing. It would also mean that Auckland get a chance to nab some players. I'm going to finish with one point here before we get out of this conversation. I've got some weird logic for you. Now, everyone says the Blues should have the best players because typically the majority of the best schoolboy rugby players are playing schoolboy rugby in Auckland, typically, not solely. But here's my point about how the system currently works. Anyone can go and be a scout on the sideline at a schoolboy game. Anyone can then put their bid in for a 16-year-old player in the hope that that investment will pay off. But the Blues can only do that once. And then four other franchises can do it once, which means 80% chance that another franchise gets the best player and only a 20% chance for the Blues in their own backyard bets on the best player.
Even 20% would imply a greater return on investment than the one we've had.
There is that. Boys, we're going to finish with one pick because undoubtedly for me, the game of the round, Super Rugby, this round, the Southern Classic, the Highlanders taking on the Crusaders. The Crusaders now top of the table. The Highlanders just knocked off the Chiefs off the top of the table. It's at Forsyth Bar. It will be a full house. There will be beers. There will be mad students. Who wins?
Well, if there's going to be beers.
There's beers.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel like you just got to go with the hometown advantage on this. It's going to be a squeaker, and I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I'll just go with Highlanders because that feels right. But I just feel like those evil kind of automatons in the Crusaders will somehow do it. Oh, robots. I don't know. I'm going to pick the Highlanders.
There you go. Home side advantage. No, I'm gonna just pick a sneaky upset here. I'm going to pick the Crusaders coming down to Forsyth Bar. And
pop, a very brave pick.
Popping the balloon.
Picking the people on top of the table.
Hey. Hey, come on. What, you're giving me the home advantage like, line and then you're going against
let
me?
Let me go out there with the crazy one. Scotty.
That's it for this week on the Rugby Pass Podcast. Don't forget, sign up today. All the rugby you could ever hope for and much more besides rugbypass.com. Get into it now.